Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. On this tax day, we will begin with an overview of the economy and look into the issue of growing economic inequality as the Republican Congress moves to reward the richest 1% of the 1% with the repeal of the so-called death tax, along with a loophole that allows America's wealthiest families to pass on their estates to heirs without paying a penny of capital gains or taxes. Jeff Madrick, a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books, whose latest book is Seven Bad Ideas, How Mainstream Economists Have Damaged America and the World, joins us to discuss who among us pays their fair share on tax day. Then we'll assess the future of President Obama's historic opening to Cuba, now that Cuba is to be removed from the list of nations that sponsor terrorism. We'll speak with William Neogrand, a professor of government at American University and the author of Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana, and discuss whether concerns about the so-called American terrorists who have been given political asylum in Cuba will be offset by the anti-Castro Cuban terrorists living in the United States. Then, with the Department of Education finally moving against a predatory for-profit college that misled students and falsified job placements, slapping Heald College with a $29.7 million fine, we will speak with David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report, who was founding director of Campus Progress. We'll examine the recent remarks by Hillary Clinton, who has just started her 2016 presidential campaign, charging that those overpriced, low-quality diploma mills, which are almost entirely subsidized by the taxpayer, are ruining students' lives. And before we begin, I'd like to invite you to the UCLA Hammer Forum. I'm moderating tonight the Global Underground Economy at 7:30 p.m. We'll have James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and the lead researcher for the Tax Justice Network, and Zorka Malin, senior legal advisor at Global Witness. We'll be talking about a world awash with off-the-books, criminal, kleptocratic, untaxed, and dirty money that is laundered into the global financial system. Again, tonight at 7:30 p.m. at the UC Hammer Forum in Westwood, the Global Underground Economy, free and open to the public. Join me. And joining us now is Jeff Madrick, a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books and a former economics columnist for the New York Times. He is director of the Bernard L. Schwartz Rediscovering Government Initiative at the Century Foundation, editor of Challenge Magazine, and visiting professor of humanities at the Cooper Union. His books include Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present, and his latest, Seven Bad Ideas, How Mainstream Economists Have Damaged America and the World. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Madrick.
Always a pleasure, Ian.
And on this tax day, of course, preceding this tax day, on Tuesday, April the 14th, there was the 19th annual Equal Pay Day. And being in April, it symbolizes the fact that the average woman in America would have to work all last year and into April this year to earn as much as the average man did in 2014.
Right.
So that is... that, along with income inequality, at least in terms of what we've learned about Hillary Clinton's campaign, as she's just come out of the gate only a couple of days ago, she's focusing on those issues. So do you think income inequality and pay equity are going to be big issues in the coming year?
Well, you know, I can only hope so. I'm anxious to hear what she has to say and whether it's anything new. You know, one way to get more equality is to grow faster and get the unemployment rate way down. So she could maybe say something about that. But I think I'm a little bit concerned that she will have largely modest program proposals. I don't think there will be any kind of direct jobs proposal. There won't be a Wall Street tax that can be distributed around. I hope there's some job training talk and that would be useful. I would, of course, most of all like to see an increase in progressive taxes and have that be used to go to the poor, especially the poor children. My pet, the pet idea I'm advocating is cash allowances for all children of $300 to $400 a month. But I don't know how much radical stuff we will see at all or how much really inventive stuff. I'm just not that optimistic. I think she's got to worry about, number one, I don't know how much she believes in it. I know she believes in children and women, surely, and reasonable rights and opportunities for them. And I know she has, as a person, considerable compassion. But I don't know how far she's willing to go, whether it will be far enough. She's worried about the right wing. But
the right wing, Jeff, are heading into absolute loony land. I mean, the House Republicans this week are voting to repeal what they call the death tax, which will mean that the richest 1% of 1% of Americans who are only affected by this repeal will not have to pay any tax on, or the heirs won't have to pay any tax, or they won't have to pay any tax. And not only that, they can pass on the wealthiest of families in this country can pass on their estates to their heirs without paying a penny in capital gains or taxes. This is at a time that, when you consider, it's not just that the income inequality is growing, it's growing at an extraordinary clip globally. Only 5 years ago, in 2010, it took 388 billionaires to control the equivalent of half of the world's wealth, the wealth equivalent of the bottom half of all of the people on this planet. Now it only takes 85 billionaires to control half of the world's wealth.
Well, you're not going to get any disagreement with me. What people should understand is I think it's $5.4 million of any estate is excluded from any taxability at all, which leaves very few estates in America and leaves all that are required to pay estate tax. And this is done under the claim that there are a bunch of farmers who are clobbered by the estate tax. It's just hard to believe. On the other hand, to get back to the original point, the Republicans, it may sound like they're shooting themselves in the foot. For some reason, Americans don't like estate taxes. But then there's what looks like a turnabout. Chris Christie says he wants to cut Social Security benefits to the well-off. Now, I think that would be a mistake because it would begin to undo the universal appeal of Social Security. It's clever, but, he sounds like he sounds on the face of it, it really isn't entirely true, but he sounds like on the face of it, he's developing a program that will help the middle and poorer worker rather than the rich worker. So I'm not so sure there won't be room for the right wing to come up with a few proposals like that that will put Hillary Clinton on guard. I suspect, in fact, she's going to propose some reductions in benefits, in Social Security benefits. So I think although the Republicans are loony, and a large proportion of them have been loony, who can remember when they weren't anymore? I think there's some reason to be concerned that there could be strategizing that could challenge Hillary some.
But in terms of Chris Christie offering up a proposal that, you suggested it could even be kind of a Trojan horse type of proposal, but make himself look more populist. This is a guy that just gave a multi-billion dollar gift to Exxon. They were supposed to clean up some pollution that they were responsible for in New Jersey. And instead of paying the billions that the state had assessed, Christie got them off on it for about $200 million. It's extraordinary. I mean, again, it goes back to the Republicans in Congress. Are they such whores to the billionaires in this country that they are just so nakedly doing their bidding?
Well, I think there's a lot. This estate tax is clearly a naked gift to the very rich. The influence of the Koch brothers has been quite clear. I think a good thing that Hillary said was she seems to want to attack the campaign contribution system in this country, which is so offensive and perverted and anti-democracy. I mean, it's really undoing the democracy. So I can't fully explain the Republicans, but I always worry about them. I can't take any comfort in the fact that they do things that should estrange them from the working American. And the working American hasn't been sufficiently estranged from Republicans since Ronald Reagan, who told them he's going to cut taxes and actually basically raise their taxes by raising Social Security taxes. So it's hard for me to explain, and I worry about it all the time. I hope Hillary Clinton comes out swinging and doesn't play too defensive.
Well, you know, that is, of course, a great mystery. And you'd think on tax day when people are paying taxes and perhaps they're not aware of the extent to which how the very wealthy are getting away with paying fewer, less and less tax. Corporate America gets away with paying its fair share of corporation tax. They never pay anything like what they're supposed to pay, even though they keep saying we've got to lower our corporate tax rates because they're the highest in the world. Well, guess what? They park all their money abroad and don't pay it in any case. I mean,
yeah.
I just find it just so unbelievably
frustrated.
Unbelievably unfair. But I don't get, you're right, I don't get the impression that the average working people in this country have any idea of how they're getting hosed.
You know, I worked with Senator Kennedy, and this for Ted Kennedy, for a few years, doing basically some research for him and writing some speeches on special subjects. And I wrote a book with him, a forum with him. And he used to say, this is how they put it, okay? Here are two people, right? They both work hard, but one of them buys a new Cadillac every year and goes out to the best restaurants, buys his wife a new fur coat. And the other one just buys a Chevy, doesn't get a new car every year. His wife has a good Republican cloth coat, doesn't overspend, eats home except on special days. Now, that guy has saved a lot of money. Are we going to tax that guy for being thrifty and depriving himself and sacrificing and building up an estate? Or should we not tax that guy? Well, I don't think we should tax that guy who's been thrifty compared to the guy who's been profligate. That's how Senator Kennedy always put it. He put it more eloquently than I'm putting it. But that's a fairly common view. People work all their life. They saved up their money. Don't tax them. But the fact is they're not being taxed. There's a $5.4 million exclusion. Only a very, very small part of America gets taxed, and the very, very wealthy. And doing away with that tax would give them, I don't know, some huge tax bonus.
Well, you have to add to it the loophole.
The number was,
yeah, but the loophole. There's a loophole that in this bill that the Republicans are opposing, that not just lets off the, and it's 10.86 million for a couple. Anything above that, and it's only the very richest of the heirs in this country that are affected. But also, these estates can pass down all of their stock portfolios and real estates without paying capital gains. That's also the loophole that they've included, which will mean that these estates will perpetuate themselves without paying a dime of tax on forever. And that will accelerate America's drift away from democracy towards plutocracy.
Well, of course, that's true. I don't know what to do about it except become frustrated, angry, and increasingly disturbed about the course of the American economy. I worry about democracy, and I certainly worry about social equity. But the Americans have to begin standing up and voting the right way. And they have to take responsibility for this inequity and come to terms with how bad the philosophical ideas of the right wing are for that, not only for them, but for the future of their children and the future of wealth in America. I don't mean individual wealth, but the wealth of the economy. We don't invest in transportation infrastructure. We know, as you know, out there, we don't adequately invest in water. What a mess that currently is. We don't adequately invest in K-12 in lots of regions of the country. Highly unequal spending for kids in this country. How could that be equality of opportunity? On and on. We don't, we have the highest child poverty rate in the world, and we're giving a huge tax cut to the very, very wealthy. Let's not let the media off the hook here. They don't They, you know, it's always a, it's so often a he said, she said media, as if each argument deserves equal weight, and they don't. It's an outrage, and we're being bled dry of our resources rather than investing them in what can guarantee a decent future for the nation.
Well, Jeff Madrick, it would seem, though, that you could make the argument in terms of this estate tax and preserving the estates in perpetuity without having to pay taxes, that creating this whole new class of aristocracy in America, that these heirs to these fortunes that get them untouched and untaxed are not necessarily the right people to be stewards of the money. They're, you know, the people that create wealth, often their heirs, are simply not up to the task. So as a free marketeer, you can make the argument that this is going to be bad for the overall economy in the long run.
Right. The other thing, Ian, of course, is as a free marketeer and as an American, you tend to believe people should get paid what they earn, that they shouldn't get paid what they don't earn. That's the classic case Republicans make about all kinds of social welfare policies, any kind of social policy. And here is an extreme case of heirs being paid what they had nothing to do with. And, of course, they're not necessarily innately incapable. They just have no motivation to use the money well and invest it well. There are exceptions, but there are lots of waste. And a lot of it may be spent on the next bigger boat and so forth. So there are more than a few ironies in this attitude. It's I wouldn't even call it hypocritical. I would call it unintelligent and deeply self-destructive on the part of the American people to tolerate anything like this.
Well, just in closing then, Jeff Madrick, do you think that given how often fractured the left is and how much of the political left in this country is dreaming of Elizabeth Warren's presidential run that's not going to happen and already have given up on Hillary, and, you know, identity politics, of course, come into play. And that's always been crippled the left. And you'd think that the one unifying thing that every working person in this country, whatever their color, whatever their religion, whatever their ethnicity, ought to be aware of and have in common and be in solidarity towards each other on is the lack of pay equity and the growing disparity in income and the fact that people are working, most people in this country are working hard for less, while a few people are getting away with not having to work and getting incredibly rewarded beyond any possible conceivable needs that they could have.
Well, Hillary and other members of the alleged left, and, you know, they're really centrists for the most part, they have to present Americans with a real jobs program and a real plan to get their wages up. The federal government can create jobs. They can make valuable work for people and pay them reasonably well. We can have a higher minimum wage. We can have a real living wage requirements around the country. That can be imposed. But there's always some argument from a mainstream economist that will cost jobs. We learn that's less and less true. There are a number of options for us if we had a courageous left leader who had genuine credibility. Elizabeth Warren has been fighting great fights in many areas, but she hasn't said much about jobs programs. Correct me if I'm wrong, Ian, you may follow it more closely than I. She talks a lot about inequities, but we need a growth plan. And we need that goes along with the jobs program and recognizes the failure in many respects of letting the market do it, the free market do it. That doesn't make you an extreme anti-capitalist. It simply makes you a realist. People are not paid in America what they deserve. Companies often have too much power. Jobs are being sent overseas. Sometimes that is efficient, but often it's just not efficient or simply a short-term gain for companies. We really live in an oligopoly world. You can't name an industry any longer that's really competitive. It's run by two or three or four companies. and they have power over workers, and they have power over the products you and I and all your listeners can buy, over the choice we have, over the innovation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we really let it go out of hand. You know, when Ronald Reagan was elected, I was an adult. And people would say, ah, it's only one term. Well, it really hasn't been one term. It's been countless terms. It's been almost every term. The deterioration continues. I hope there is a, we keep reading about a reaction of people, a little rebellion, demands for living wages, demands for wage increases, demands for companies to abide by the labor laws that already exist. All of that, I suppose that's a ray of hope, and I'm going to cling to that ray of hope.
Okay, well,
the beginning of something.
On that note, Jeff Madrick, I thank you so much for joining us here on Tax Day.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jeff Madrick, who's a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books and a former economics columnist for the New York Times. He's a director of the Bernard L. Schwartz Rediscovering Government Initiative at the Century Foundation, editor of Challenge Magazine, and visiting professor of humanities at the Cooper Union. His books include Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance, and The Decline of America, 1970 to the Present, and his latest, Seven Bad Ideas, How Mainstream Economists Have Damaged America and the World. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into the removal of Cuba from the list of nations that sponsor terrorism.
What's my name? What's my station? Oh, just tell me what I should do. I don't need to be kind to the armies of night that would do such injustice to you. Or bow down and be grateful and say, should take all that you see to the men who move on.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William Leo Grand, who's a professor of government at American University and a specialist in Latin American politics and U.S. foreign policy towards Latin America. He has been a frequent advisor to government and private sector agencies and has written five books, including Our Own Backyard, The United States in Central America, 1977 to 1992, and most recently, Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Leo Grand.
My pleasure.
And the U.S. has, or the Obama administration has moved to take Cuba off the U.S. list of nations that sponsor terrorism. Obviously, it's long overdue and not unexpected, but it is a precursor to moving ahead to deal with this failed embargo. One of the things I find extraordinary about this is that just on Monday, Florida GOP Senator Marco Rubio announced that he's running for president, and he chose Miami's Freedom Tower as his venue. And then he went on to castigate Hillary Clinton and with a not-so-subtle dig at his former mentor, Jeb Bush, by talking about them being politicians of a past era. And to my mind, given that Marco Rubio's central political fixation, if you will, over the years has been to maintain the blockade on Cuba, it would seem to me you can make a pretty strong case that Marco Rubio is a politician of the past, not the future, given his central political position on Cuba.
Well, his policy on Cuba is circa 1980. It really harkens back to Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush. It really is a Cold War policy, a policy of hostility based on events and Cuban behavior that stopped back in the 1990s.
So I suppose we shouldn't dwell on this because I don't think his chances are pretty strong, but it does look, as I say, anachronistic compared to what President Obama is achieving.
It does. And one has to keep in mind, though, that I think Marco Rubio is trying to simply distinguish himself from the wide Republican political field by saying really extreme things about the policy, calling it ridiculous, calling the president the worst negotiator the United States has ever had in the White House, and so on and so on. He's really also trying to appeal to a conservative Cuban-American Republican voter who will be important in the Florida Republican primary. So I think that's his target audience right now. I don't think it's going to sell very well with the American people generally, who have, according to opinion polls, supported the president's opening to Cuba overwhelmingly.
And is that your understanding, that that therefore what just took place in Panama at the Summit of the Americas has played well?
Well, there's no question that it has. You could see in the summit itself that Latin American leaders were universally supportive of the new U.S. policy towards Cuba. All of them praised it back in December when Obama first announced it. And here in the United States, the public opinion polls that have been done since December are very consistent, with 60% or more of the general public in favor of this policy. And the most recent poll of Cuban Americans in South Florida showed 51% of them in favor of the policy.
So, William Liljegren, what was your sense then of the summit in terms of how Raul Castro and President Obama seemed to sort of steal the limelight? In contrast, I was struck by Venezuela's President Maduro's speech that was laced with profanity. It seemed really out of step.
I think, President Maduro was out of step. There was at the summit this sense of having moved past this Cold War issue of the conflict between Cuba and the United States, which was so widely supported by the other presidents. Maduro's complaints were really sort of spoiling the party, if you will, and the atmospherics for him were very bad. And as the summit went on, he became a little more polite. I think sensing that his really aggressive tone was hurting him more than it was hurting Obama.
But what is the explanation for this schizophrenic U.S. policy, where on the one hand we're opening up to Cuba, on the other hand we're calling Venezuela a threat to American national security?
Well, Venezuela is in crisis, of course. The economy is in very bad shape. The confrontation between the government and its supporters and the opposition's supporters has been intensifying. And the Congress passed legislation calling on the president to impose some kind of sanctions on Venezuela. The sanctions he imposed are fairly modest sanctions. They only focus on seven individuals, not on the government or the Venezuelan economy as a whole. And in order to exercise his legal authority to impose these sanctions, the president was required to declare that Venezuela posed a threat to U.S. national security. Nobody thinks that Venezuela poses a direct or immediate threat to the United States, and administration officials have been trying to explain that they don't really mean that they see Venezuela as an aggressive threat, but declaring it a threat to U.S. security was a legal requirement for the president to exercise those sanctions.
So how do you how does one figure out what's happening here in terms of Obama's foreign policy? It seems as though the Republicans are backing off on going after him on Cuba, which is, of course, has always been a bête noire in American politics. Maybe the fact that he's dealing with Raul Castro and not Fidel Castro takes a little bit of the edge off. But just yesterday, the president had to compromise with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on the Iran deal, which now the Senate and the Congress have some input into. And we know that many of them want to scuttle this deal, and they certainly have sided with Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu and many of the senators who voted to become part of the negotiations or to look over Obama's shoulders are those that are very sympathetic to Netanyahu, including the co-chair, Ben Cardin, and, of course, the other co-chair who just had to step down because of political corruption charges, Menendez, was even much more in the camp of Netanyahu, as he's also been in the camp of the anti-Castro Cuban lobby. But he's in trouble, and it turned out that just yesterday his co-conspirator was just indicted for Medicare fraud. So I think he's in some serious trouble. But what's your sense, though, of this difference? Why are the Congress sort of, is it because they're just more obsessed with Iran than Cuba, or is Obama just getting lucky because Iran's taking all the heat?
Well, first let me say, I think that we're going to see the Republican Congress coming after Obama on the Cuba issue. They have 45 days to review his finding that Cuba does not belong on the terrorism list. And I think they will use that opportunity to vigorously criticize the president on Cuba, because it fits into this broader narrative that the Republican Party is weaving, that Obama is weak on foreign policy and too conciliatory with our adversaries. In the case of Iran, there I think the problem the president has is that Israel has broad and deep support among Democrats in Congress. And so when the government of Israel says this is a bad deal and threatens Israeli security, there are a lot of Democrats who are swayed by that argument. And they're playing an important role working with Republicans who are attacking this policy just because it's Obama's policy, and therefore forcing the president into the kind of compromise that he made.
Well, but this is a self-fulfilling prophecy. And if you say the president is, if your campaign strategy is to beat the drum and say Obama's foreign policy is weak and ineffective, it's only weak and ineffective because you're scuttling it and undermining it.
Yes, but will voters in 2016 recognize that? I mean, this has been the strategy of the Republican Party since Obama was elected, to try to prevent him from accomplishing anything so that they could run against him in 2012 as a president who was a failure. So this is just the same strategy they used domestically during Obama's first term, translated now into the second term and aiming at 2016.
So is that so? Let's focus then, William Lee Grand, on the coming month of Republican review of the taking Cuba off the list of countries that sponsor terrorism. What can they do? I mean, there's no evidence, is there?
No, well, of course, but this is not going to be a fact-based decision on the Republican side. This is a political issue, and they will use the opportunity publicly to blast the president's policy. They can't really prevent it from going forward, however. In order to block Cuba's removal from the list, the Congress would have to pass legislation, and that legislation would be subject to Obama's veto. To get it out of the Senate, then, the Republicans would have to hold all their own members and win the votes of 13 or 14 Democrats, and they're not going to do that. Already there's three or four Republicans who've endorsed the president's policy towards Cuba. So there's no chance that the Congress is going to be able to actually reverse Obama's decision, but it's an opportunity for them to hold hearings and hold a floor debate and gives them a podium, if you will, a soapbox from which they can attack Obama on Cuba and on his foreign policy more broadly.
So do you think that they can make anything of these Americans who hijacked planes in the 70s and went to Cuba? One of them apparently is high on the FBI's list of most wanted terrorists for killing a New Jersey State trooper in 1973. She, Joanne Chesmard, she received asylum in Cuba after escaping from prison in 1979. And apparently she goes now by the name of Asata Shakur. Her name's coming up, and there, of course, are others as well. Many of them have sort of become old-age pensioners. You know, they've been there a long time. Is that going to be an issue, do you think?
Well, the Republicans are trying to make that an issue. A number of them wrote letters both to the president and to Attorney General Holder, arguing that as long as those fugitives remained in Cuba, Cuba should not come off the list. The reality is, though, Cuba's not going to surrender those people. They've been given political asylum. And when the United States has raised the issue of returning them, the Cuban government's response has been that there are a number of people in the United States who committed acts of terrorism against Cuba, and Cuba would like to have them back. And, of course, the United States is not willing to return them because they've been given political asylum here.
Well, one of them who bombed a Cuban airliner, killing all passengers aboard, wasn't he pardoned by the first President Bush?
There were two Cuban-Americans who had worked with the CIA in the 1960s in its paramilitary war against Cuba, Orlando Bosch and Luis Posada Carriles. Bosch was indeed pardoned by George H.W. Bush and has passed away now, but he lived out his life in Miami. And Luis Posada Carriles is still here in the United States, living openly in Miami.
So what's your sense then, William Leogrand, just in closing, of where this... I mean, one of the things I find extraordinary about Obama is how much he's been attacked and how relentlessly he's been attacked and how deeply personal and often hateful and even racist ways in which he's been attacked. And yet somehow he's managed to achieve, I think, quite a number of things. And I suspect in time he will be seen as a very effective American president, both in terms of domestic policies and foreign policy, certainly compared to his contemporaries and predecessors.
I think that's a fair judgment. Certainly in the first 2 years that he was in the White House, when he had Democratic majorities in the Congress, he was able to achieve some extraordinary things. He saved the economy from a depression with the stimulus package. He was able to finally pass health care reform. Now, with a Republican Congress, it's harder, but he has taken some bold steps using his executive authority, the first stage in immigration reform being one, and the opening to Cuba another.
Well, William Leogrand, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Glad to be with you.
And again, I've been speaking with William Leogrand, who's a professor of government at American University and a specialist in Latin American politics and U.S. foreign policy towards Latin America. He's been a frequent advisor to government and private sector agencies and has written 5 books, including Our Own Backyard, The United States in Central America, 1977 to 1992. And most recently, Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how the Department of Education finally moved against a predatory for-profit college. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of the Campus Progress and senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Halperin.
Thanks, Ian.
And Heald College, which is a part of the for-profit college chains owned by Corinthian Colleges Incorporated, have just been slapped with a $29.7 million fine and a ban on enrolling new students in an investigation by the Department of Education that found that the college had showed a blatant disregard for the federal school, a federal student loan program, and they found 947 false job placement rates dating back to at least 2010. So is this a change, do you think? Is the finally Arne Duncan and the Department of Education going to crack down on this for-profit college racket, or is just this is the result of growing agitation from the public and particularly from the more than 100 former Corinthian students who are refusing to repay their federal student loans as a part of a debt strike, trying to force the Department of Education to forgive debts incurred by this for-profit college racket?
This is a very good sign that the department, which has not traditionally been an enforcement agency and has let a lot of bad behavior go on, particularly by for-profit colleges, may finally be asserting itself and doing the right thing. But it won't be enough if they limit themselves to Corinthian. Corinthian College, which owned Heald, which acquired it in 2010, is probably the worst of the worst in terms of the large for-profit colleges. But it's not that much worse than other chains like EDMC, University of Phoenix, Kaplan, ITT Tech, Bridgepoint. All of these companies have engaged in similar kinds of bad behavior. All of them are under investigation by multiple federal and state law enforcement agencies. And all of them, if the facts lead that way, ought to be treated firmly, and the department ought to be getting tough on them as well.
So in terms of getting public awareness, I know we've spoken a lot about this issue over the years, and it's still, nevertheless, the racket persists. This is, the reason I call it a racket is that these for-profit colleges depend, I think, about to the tune of over 90% of their income comes from us, the taxpayers. And on tax day, it really does hurt to think that our tax dollars are going to these institutions who use our tax dollars to advertise falsely, to recruit kids under false pretenses, particularly young, aspiring kids from minority communities and veterans, and then leave them with a lifetime of debt and a worthless diploma. It's just cruel and unusual punishment, and it's all being done on the taxpayer's dime. And it's only happening because we have so much corruption in our political system in Washington that they allow this to happen. But there are voices speaking out, and I noticed that Congresswoman Maxine Waters, the top Democrat on the House Financial Services Committee, she's supporting these debt strikers, these student debt strikers. So, David, after all the years of you banging the drum, alerting us to what's going on in this for-profit college racket, do you think that there's a shift underway?
I do think we are seeing a shift. I do think that the truth came out, and it is a truth so compelling, as you say, that students are being deceived and ripped off and their lives ruined at taxpayer expense, that it is harder and harder for politicians to keep on smiling and saying what a wonderful industry this is. Jeb Bush last year appeared at the conference, the big convention of the For-Profit College Trade Association, APSCU, and he did say they were wonderful and that they were being persecuted by the Obama administration. So many in the Republican Party, I think, are still willing to make this deal that we'll take the money and we'll pretend everything is okay. But I do think it politically in the last cycle we saw it was harder and harder to embrace the industry and more people were taking them on. And I think that it does seem tougher. On the other hand, this industry still has a huge amount of money that us taxpayers have given them. And they continue to fight on all fronts in the Congress, in the courts, and with the White House and in the states, and with the creditors as well, to try to make sure try to see if they can go back to business as usual, which is take the money and no accountability. But it is encouraging that the public has woken up, that there are champions like Congresswoman Waters, Senator Elizabeth Warren, Senator Dick Durbin, and yesterday Hillary Rodham Clinton, candidate for president, in her first campaign appearance, singled out the for-profit colleges for criticism, and I think that was also a positive sign.
And you mentioned Hillary Rodham Clinton speaking at the Kirkwood Community College in Monticello, Iowa. She's been on a van trip, road trip across from New York to Iowa. And obviously she's being followed by an enormous caravan of press And that was, I think, an important moment where she took aim at these predatory for-profit colleges for their overpriced, low-quality programs that are ruining students' lives. How did that strike you? I mean, she's also taken on some even bigger themes in a way by going after Wall Street and economic inequality and the huge disparity between CEO pay and workers' pay. And in general, she sounds a lot like Elizabeth Warren.
Well, that's why yesterday I coined the phrase Hillarizabeth Warren. But I don't mean that in a way that suggests she's being cynical, because I think that, you know, there was always a progressive in Hillary, but there's also a Clintons, Bill and Hillary Clinton, that have become accustomed to, you know, spending their time with CEOs and flying on corporate jets and speaking, getting paid to speak at corporate events and being befriended and paid by people. And it is a cultural thing, and you start to feel, you know, that these are wonderful people, the people who own these for-profit colleges and private equity firms and banks. And, you know, I think that she is going to have to, she's going to try probably to split the difference a little bit. But she sounded like she's lining up with the aspirations of working people, the people who are falling prey to credit card schemes and payday lending and for-profit colleges, and who also, you know, and while they're getting ripped off, also have a hard time earning a living because labor unions' power is down and minimum wage is down. And all of these conditions of inequality exist not so much because of the free market, but because these companies have gotten good at something that they really, you know, we didn't ask them to excel at, which is lobbying. They lobby to get all these advantages and to keep workers' wages down and to keep union organizing down and to protect all the scams that make all these big companies money. So I would like to see Hillary be a champion, you know, not only on the for-profit college issue, but on all of them, a champion of the aspirations of working people and middle-class people to have a great future the way they hoped that, you know, and often were able to have in, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago. And now it's a much more desperate situation for people in those situations. They need a champion. If she is that champion, boy, will I embrace her and support her.
Well, but you have to contrast that with Jeb Bush, who is considered by many to be the most likely Republican presidential candidate to get through the primaries, although I'm not sure that's a sure thing. But still, the fact that he spoke as a guest, a paid keynote speaker at the Association of these for-profit colleges, their lobbying group, and praised what they do, and on top of that, as well as taking a big fee, he also pushed this ridiculous idea that somehow these poor, beleaguered for-profit colleges are being persecuted by the Obama administration. My understanding is that every time the Obama administration's tried to do something to protect these students from these predatory organizations, the lobbyists have gone crazy and have continually tried to, and often succeeded in, watering down efforts by the White House to rein them in.
That's correct. I don't actually know if Jeb Bush was paid. Most of their speakers do get paid, including the Mike Love version of the Beach Boys who performed there, and the fake version of Kool and the Gang and Creedence Clearwater Revival. So, and Wesley Clark spoke, and so they're able to co-opt people. And Jeb Bush may have been there to get paid, but he may have just been there to collect the cash later as a candidate. No doubt there will be a lot of cash flowing to Jeb Bush and other candidates. I think they're vying in the for-profit college primary to see who can suck up to them the most, which is pretty common in the GOP and a lot of Democratic candidates, too. And as you say, it's
corruption. But David, just a second. They're sucking up to these people to get what ultimately is money from you and me and every taxpayer that's listening.
They have more incentive to give campaign contributions than anybody because they're entirely, except defense contractors would be similar, because they're almost entirely a creature of federal policy. And we have created a monster. They have the money to influence policy, and they get the money from us. And President Obama's administration has tried to break that cycle, but not probably tried hard enough. They always get intimidated by the lobbyists for this industry, and they also get charmed because the lobbyists for this industry, the most effective lobbyist, as we've discussed before, is Don Graham. He was the owner, in addition to Kaplan For-Profit College, of the Washington Post until recently. He's also someone that went to their prep schools, goes to their charity events, and he said, "My school is wonderful.
and therefore there shouldn't be a gainful employment rule that will penalize schools, would leave students in enormous debt. And the response to that should have been, if your school is wonderful, then you have no fear from a rule that will penalize schools that leave students with enormous debt. But they didn't ask that question, and they watered down the rule twice when he came calling. Now he's in court with his trade association, the one Jeb Bush spoke with the same law firm that represented George Bush and Bush versus Gore, the most expensive, most talented law firm that money can buy, to say that this rule should get struck down a second time and that there shouldn't be any accountability for for-profit colleges, which is a ridiculous position, whether you're a taxpayer, whether you're a conservative who thinks government should be accountable, whether you're someone who believes that poor people deserve not to be ripped off. The only response they have is money, and they're using that money to try to thwart any kind of rational, sensible result here. And the result is students who are lied to and their lives are ruined. And what did Heald College do? What are the kind of things that merited a $30 million fine? They're supposed to tell students and government honestly how many of their graduates get jobs. And so a student who was an accounting graduate from Heald College, Corinthian-owned Heald College, got a job at Taco Bell at the counter, and they said that counted as an accounting job. That's the kind of fraud that is committed with our tax dollars, and that's what, for 5 years, I and my colleagues who represent students, veterans, civil rights, consumers, have been trying to stop. But we get thwarted at every turn. And as you say, there's a chance now we're winning, mostly because there's been a shift to law enforcement investigating. State attorneys general and federal agencies have been cracking down. And finally, Department of Education is exerting its own authority to do something about this. But there's just still a lot more to be done beyond punishing these schools. The students need relief, not just at Corinthian, but at all of these big schools where they were lied to and deceived. So this is a fight that will go on, but fortunately, with leadership of people like Congresswoman Waters and Senator Warren, Senator Durbin, we think we have a chance to move towards a situation where you can be a for-profit college, but you're not going to be able to make money by ripping students off. You're only going to be able to make money by actually training students for careers and helping them succeed.
So has it been the state's attorney general and the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that was a result of the Dodd-Frank Act? And, of course, that was fought tooth and nail by the banking lobby and by mostly the Republican supporters, although a number of Democrats have also carried water for the banking lobby. Have they been really doing the heavy lifting? And is the Department of Education, which really has a lot of jurisdiction over this, have they been asleep at the switch?
They've been asleep at the switch for the most part for many, many years. And in the Bush administration, they were affirmatively, you know, flipping the switch the wrong direction. In the Obama administration, the culture has changed a little bit, but it has still been difficult to get enforcement. But yes, the new consumer agency, now the Federal Trade Commission, the Securities Exchange Commission, and the Justice Department have all been looking into abuses. And I think, you know, the Department of Education is finally coming up and seeing its responsibility. But at the same time, they allowed the other part of Corinthian, most of Everest College, the school's not in California, to be bought by a debt collecting company, ECMC, with a sale to which many of our coalition objected. And we said that ECMC was not behaving responsibly and acting just sort of like the previous owner, and the department went ahead with the sale anyway. We don't think that was a good idea. We don't think it was good for students. But so we continue to fight them. I think they are people of good intention, but there's a long way to go to change the culture there. They think of the schools as their clients, as their constituency, rather than the students. I'm pretty confident that it remains the case.
Well, but there's, you know, I'm trying to figure out who this Arnie Duncan is, then, the Secretary of Education.
Yeah.
He's a very close friend of Obama's. You know, they play basketball a lot, apparently. And I think he's an ex-basketball player.
Yeah.
And a lot of critics of the department in terms of its handling or its, you know, lack of assertion of its authority over these for-profit colleges have suggested that the Education Department hasn't coddled these embattled corporations with emergency cash inflows and facilitated sales of distressed assets while continuing to collect from defrauded students.
Yep. That's the situation. They're worried about a number of different things. They're worried about all the money that would have to go back to students in terms of all the money that, you know, we don't have so much money. I think they're worried about being seen by, you know, conservatives as Obamacare. If they try too hard to, you know, influence the outcomes here, they'll be seen as like meddling in the economy. Of course, this particular sector of the economy is entirely a creature of taxpayer money. So that is not a valid concern, but I think they worry about it. They do worry about the countless lawyers and lobbyists for this industry who are in their face all the time. And all of those concerns often seem to trump the concern of students who were ripped off. They really should admit that a lot of these schools were systematic frauds, and that a lot of these students were systematically defrauded and are entitled to relief and the chance to start over again. As much as that would cost, it is not fair that that our government gave money to these schools, basically represented thereby to students that these were, you know, reputable places where students could go. And yes, students bear some responsibility. They should be doing their own homework. But you have what is called an information asymmetry. These schools had every incentive and every tool in their arsenal to try to pretend to students like that they were going to get good value for their money. And they would say to students, you know, if you don't sign up today, I can't guarantee a spot, or we're only accepting 1 out of 10 students, and it would be such an achievement if you got in. And those were just lies, though, that they would accept anyone. They put students in high-pressure situations and said, your life is worthless, don't you want to make your family proud of you, and make these students cry. They would pray with them if that's what the student wanted. They would do anything they could to sign them up. They would charge prices that could be 10 times as much as a comparable or better program in a community college. And that's all they cared about was signing them up. They didn't care if they succeeded. They referred to students, not as students, but as starts, asses in classes, pieces of business. The whole goal was numbers, signing people up. That's a racket that's gone on for 15 years with many, not all of these schools. Some of them are fine institutions. But for many of these institutions, it's all just a numbers game. Deposit the federal checks, and who cares what happened to the student? And in that situation where the Department of Education said, yes, this is a college that, you know, you can go to and get federal aid, the department bears some responsibility.
Well, David Halpern, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David Halpern as a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of Campus Progress and senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. And again, there's still time to get to the UCLA Hammer Forum I'm moderating tonight at 7:30. The Global Underground Economy will have James Henry, economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and the lead researcher for the Tax Justice Network, along with Zorka Malin, senior legal advisor at Global Witness. We'll be talking about the world awash with off-the-books, criminal, kleptocratic, untaxed, and dirty money that is laundered into the global financial system. Again, tonight at 7:30 p.m., the Global Underground Economy, free and open to the public. Join me in Westwood at the UCLA Hammer Forum. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Molly Lewis. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.